Today is Monday, June 5th. We're going to work on membrane transport, epithelial tissues, and time for questions on test one. Okay, so we're on page 37. On Wednesday of last week, we talked about passive transport. And just to kind of bring that back into focus again, passive transport means there's no ATP or energy required by the cell to move items across the membrane. Now, the catch is, with osmosis, we're moving a specific type of substance across the membrane. What is it?
Water.
Water, good. So, in the case of water being moved across the membrane, sometimes we can't move solutes. Sometimes they're too big. Maybe they don't have a channel to travel through. So, the catch is that osmosis is the movement of water or the diffusion of water across the membrane. But we're going against the gradient here. We're actually going toward a higher solute concentration. So I know that we preach when we talk about passive transport, high to low solute concentration all the time with diffusion. But in fact, with osmosis, we're moving toward a low to high solute concentration. So if you look at this animation, the water molecules are blue and the solutes are green. If you watch it for just a moment, you'll notice that those water molecules are traveling back and forth across the membrane. But what about the solutes? Can they travel? They're not traveling yet. They never cross over that membrane to the other side. And that creates for us a concentration gradient. So if you look at the right-hand side of this membrane, it looks like there's a lot more sugar molecules or solutes on that right-hand side in comparison to what you've got on the left-hand side of that membrane. So we've got an unequal distribution of sugar molecules, meaning we've got more sugar on the right over here and less sugar on the left. Since we can't move the sugar molecules for whatever reason, we're going to move the water molecules instead to change the concentration of those sugar molecules. So let me give you kind of an analogy to think about this. Do you make sweet tea or do you sweeten your coffee or sweeten anything that you may drink? Okay. Sometimes we accidentally put in too much sugar, and instead of just dumping the whole concoction, what could you do to make it less sweet? Add more water, exactly. So on this right-hand side, there's too much sugar. It's too sweet, so to speak. And the way we dilute it down is to add more water. So you may notice there are some water molecules moving both left and right across that membrane, but the majority should be ending up over here to dilute down that sugar. So since sugar can't move, we're going to move the water molecules to dilute down the sugar that we do have. So that's the game with osmosis. We're going to move toward the higher solute or salt concentration, or in this case, sugar concentration. So what is the goal? What are we trying to do?
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium, yes. So we're trying to get the same concentration of salts or solutes or sugar on either side of that membrane. And since we can't move the solutes, salts, or sugars, we can move the water. And it's the movement of that water that helps to make the same concentration on both sides. So we have a phrase that kind of summarizes this. You've probably heard it before. Water follows what?
Salt.
Water follows salt. Yes, so that's a good way to keep straight what happens here. Water always goes toward the saltier side of the membrane. Hey, it could be sugar. It could be some other type of solute. But if you keep straight that water follows salt, that reminds us that water goes to the highest solute concentration. Okay, and you had it right. The goal here is equilibrium. We're trying to make the same concentration on either side of that membrane. Okay, so far so good. Okay, got any questions so far? It doesn't really matter. Yeah, because this could be inside a cell, that could be outside, or we could flip-flop it. Either way, yeah. So I should tell you there's actually something wrong with that animation. I'm trying to find you the right picture here. I don't know. There it is. In fact, water molecules don't necessarily travel through the phospholipid bilayer. Water molecules actually need their own special channel. So I did want to mention this because it's important. It's actually a discovery that took place around 17 years ago. So around the year 2000, they said, oh, that's how water molecules move. They don't just wiggle their way through the phospholipid bilayer. They have to go through a channel. And that channel is a protein channel. You might recognize it as an integral channel. How is it integral?
Because it's inside the membrane.
Yeah, all the way through the membrane, right? Okay, and it happens to allow water molecules to travel to the highest salt concentration. And the reason that this was a really important discovery is because we know those phospholipid tails don't like what?
Water.
They don't like water. They're hydrophobic. And so, you know, scientists were wondering, how is it that water travels from one side of the membrane to another? Well, it has to do with the fact that we're dealing with high to low solvent or low to high solute concentration through that protein channel. So that's just something I wanted to throw in there. That's an important part of osmosis. Okay, so let's talk about various types of osmosis, various types of solutions. Let's first hit the easy one, which is an isotonic solution. And I'll let this run and play while we talk, because it's going to do it out of order from the way we do it. But iso as a prefix is a really good clue. What does iso as a prefix say?
Same.
Good. So what is the same in an isotonic solution?
Concentrations,
right. So we're looking at the concentration inside a cell, and we're comparing that to the concentration outside the cell. And so the issue here is that could be interstitial fluid, that could be blood plasma, that could be any fluid that's outside cells in our bodies. To kind of lump it all together, what is that fluid outside your cells known as? Let's see, inside is intracellular, extracellular, good. Okay, so yeah, that could be blood plasma, it could be interstitial fluid, whatever it is, that solution is what's outside the cell's membrane. So since we're dealing with the same concentration, if our cell has a concentration of 3% solutes, what must be the solution's concentration?
3%.
It must be the same, it must be 3% also. So where's the higher concentration of solutes?
It's equal.
There is none, right? There is no higher area of solutes. So that means that the water movement is going to be pretty much equal coming into and out of that cell. So in this case, we say our cell is in what? Equilibrium. Yeah, it's an isotonic, you're right. It's equilibrium, so there's no net gain of water, no net loss. In other words, your cell will not shrivel, your cell will not bloat. Okay, so this is kind of the happy solution. Okay, so just a reminder that iso means same, and what we mean is same is the concentration of solutes inside your cell compared to the solution or extracellular fluids outside your cell. And this is the goal. This is what we want to be at. We want to be at equilibrium with our surrounding fluids. That's the easy one, right? Okay. Let's tackle the next one. It's called a hypotonic solution. And again, this may be extracellular fluid that bathes your cells. What we're going to do is tackle that hypo prefix first. It means what? Good, below. Some people say under. Let's take our cell with a 3% solute concentration one more time. This time our solution is hypotonic to our cell, so it must be
lower
than
three.
Yes, yeah, so I heard you say one, right? Does that work? Yeah, under 3, so you could say 2% for the solution, you could say 1%, 0%, as long as it's under 3%, then you're good to go. So sure, we can use 1%. So the question here is the same, where's your higher concentration of solutes?
The cell.
Yeah, so the cell is the higher concentration of solutes. Water moves to the higher concentration, because it's trying to dilute down the solutes. So water travels from the solution where?
Into the cell.
Right. So water comes into that cell. And what happens to your cell as a result?
Bloats
or swells. Good.
catch here is that water follows salt into the cell. We knew that because the higher salt concentration is in your cell. The goal for doing this is to reach equilibrium. That cell allows water to continually enter until you reach equilibrium. Unfortunately, this may never occur because your cell can only stretch so big. It's kind of like making a water balloon, right? And the more water you put in that cell, the greater swelling occurs. And what might eventually happen in this situation?
Burst,
yeah. So lysis or bursting may eventually occur. Through osmosis, let me point out some helpful hints. Hypo has an O. I'm going to use that because below has an O and bloke has an O. So that helps remind me that in a hypotonic solution, we have a concentration that's below the cell, and in those situations, the cell will bloat. So I keep the O's together. So what we drink, what we choose to drink, is all hypotonic in nature. You know, we are dehydrated, and that may often be the reason that we choose to drink something. And when you drink hypotonic fluids, they're going to bloat your cells. We don't usually drink to the point of rupturing or lysing our cells because we have a thirst mechanism that says, hey, you're thirsty, drink. And then when you fill up your cells, the thirst mechanism says, hey, you're not thirsty, stop drinking, right? So most of us won't get like a gallon of water. I don't see anybody, lugging a gallon of water to class. You know, we take little tiny bottles, we drink and sip on those bottles, and then when we're full, we're done. We stop drinking. So we listen to our bodies, and we stop drinking before we get to the point of bursting or lysing those cells. But everything that we usually choose to drink is, in fact, a hypotonic fluid. So let's talk about why a hypertonic fluid is something we wouldn't normally pick. What does the prefix hyper mean?
Above,
excessive. If our cell again is 3%, what would a hypotonic solution be?
Above
3. Yeah, so give me a number that works here.
4.
4 works, sure. Okay. So again, this solution could be the extracellular fluids that bathe our cells. It could be blood plasma. It could be interstitial fluid. And if you've got a saltier fluid surrounding your cells, now you've got more solutes in the surrounding solution. We know our old phrase here that water follows salt. So where does water move this time? Into the solution, yes. So go to the higher number. That's going to be your saltier location. And this time, what happens to your cell?
It shrinks.
It shrinks, it shrivels, right. So yeah, you're right. Water is going to leave your cell this time. Our cell shrivels or shrinks in an attempt to be the same concentration as your surrounding solution. You want to use some helpful clues here. Hyper has an E in it. In fact, it has an R too. And so does shrivel. It's got an E in there and it's got an R in there. So those are some helpful hints to keep things straight. Hypertonic solutions are saltier than our cells. They pull water out of our cells. So if you're thirsty, why would a hypertonic solution not be your best bet? Yeah, dehydrates you, right? So this is stuff like salt water, ocean water. Most of us normally don't drive to the ocean and go, I am so thirsty, let me have a drink of that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, most of us taste salty ocean water and go, ugh, that tastes horrid. So yeah, salt water is going to automatically dehydrate your cells. When you pull that fluid out of your cells, it travels to your kidneys, and your kidneys say, look at all this water, let me dump it into the urine, and then the urine is concentrated with all these salts. So unfortunately, this is a great way to dehydrate your body. We would choose to avoid drinking a hypertonic solution. Okay.
So we would do the dirty fresh water instead of the urine.
Bingo. Always pick the dirty fresh water, yeah. Yep. Urine is more concentrated, and so, of course, salt water as well. So two bad choices for us. So why, you know, there's an essay question out there that appears on a lot of those old tests. Why would dirty, contaminated-looking fresh water still be your better bet than salty ocean water? Yeah, it's not going to dehydrate you. And you probably have an immune system that can kill off whatever's in there. It'd be better to have a couple of days of diarrhea than to have guaranteed death from salt water. Yeah. So they say that it's like a week's time of drinking salt water and people become like crazy. They have hallucinations. Their kidneys shut down because they can't filter this highly salty blood, and then they die within a week's time. It sounds like a really horrible way to go, so drinking salt water is not the best bet
yeah,
there.
You can probably filter the dirty fresh water.
That's true. If you could boil it or whatnot, yeah, filter it. Yeah, there's always a better solution there with the fresh water.
So question, is surrounded on the island, it has absolutely something to do with it, but kind of just away from the lesson for a minute, if you were stranded on the island, would you choose to eat all of the plants on there instead of drinking the salty water to get your hydration?
Probably, yeah. I'd do what I could to capture dew in the morning, capture water out of your urine, eat the plants before I ever touch the salt water. Yeah. Even put it where you could get it to evaporate on the bottom of a plastic and then drink that fresh water. Anything to avoid the salt. Yeah. Speaking of salt water versus fresh water, this is a real cool experiment that you can do. If you've got kids in school and they need a quick and easy science experiment, it's just odd that one of these eggs floated and the other one sank, but just ignore that because that really, it's just a coincidence. Interesting thing to do, though, is put sugar in one solution and just put the other in plain old tap water. I did this about 7:30 this morning, and I think you can see a difference in the color of the egg yolks already. So can you see which egg yolk looks stretched and big? Let's see. Looking down in them, this one looks really stretched and see how the top looks kind of watery? So this one is bloating. So what type of solution was it in? Hypotonic, yeah. And I have done this in the past, and I've gone back to my office and let this just sit there for a few days. And guess what happens about 3 days later? It burst, yeah. So that's a nasty mess. And this one is actually in sugar water. You might notice that the egg yolk here tends to be a little more concentrated. And so it's, well, the egg yolk is concentrated, but the surrounding solution is even more concentrated. So what's happening to the water inside that egg yolk? Coming out. Yeah, so leave it in here long enough, and I've done this again in the past. You leave it for, say, 3 or 4 days. That is almost like a hard-boiled egg yolk. It gets that concentrated. All that fluid starts leaving. So when I dump them down the sink, that one actually is very hard to get to flush down the sink. So cool thing to try if you're willing to have stinky egg yolks sit around your house for a few days. While we're on the topic of osmosis one more time, I did want to mention something that occurs every now and again. A few years ago, there was a contest out in California, and they said it was Hold Your Wii for a Nintendo Wii. And they brought a bunch of people in for this radio contest, and they gave them gallons of water to drink. And unfortunately, these people drank and drank and drank, and a nurse called into the radio station, and she said, you're going to hurt somebody. And she explained what was wrong with making people drink gallons of hypotonic water. So what do you think she told the radio station?
Someone's going to die.
Someone's going to die. Why?
Because
they're going to drink themselves to death, right? What's going to happen to their cells?
bloat, yeah, and then of course rupture, explode. So the radio station says it's good. We consulted a lawyer. Not medical people. We consulted a lawyer. We're good. And she hung up the phone. I'm sure she was probably distraught having heard this conversation. And unfortunately, a 28-year-old mom of three who was playing the contest didn't win. She went home, laid down on the sofa, and called her own mother and said, I've got a really awful headache. I'm just going to take a nap. Well, unfortunately, what was swelling? Her brain. Yeah, her brain was swelling. And, you know, at the base of your brain, you have a hole in your skull called the foramen magnum. And her brain was being pushed down toward that foramen magnum, and it cut off her vital brainstem functions. And, yes, she died, unfortunately, from that. So there's a lawsuit that ensued from this. You know, basically they said, why did you guys not realize that giving people hypotonic fluids was a bad idea, especially when you give them over a short period of time? So, you know, that is a classic case of hypotonic hydration. It's water drowning, basically.
I wonder if they had to sign like a waiver or something for that.
I think they probably did. And the lawsuit, I think, that ensued was not really a clean one either. It should have been a closed and shut case, but I think it was not. So, you know, fraternities haze. They have people. They used to have people drink alcohol. Well, of course, we know what happens when you drink a bunch of alcohol. People get really drunk. They get alcohol poisoning. And then fraternities said, hey, milk's harmless. Let's drink a bunch of milk in a short period of time. No, water intoxication. Milk is hypotonic. And then they said, well, hey, water is harmless. It's, you know, everybody can drink water. No, over a short period of time, it's also a case of hypotonic hydration. So what I need to tie in here is a little kind of a flash forward into 211. Your kidneys can only filter so fast. So if you're really hot and sweaty and you come in and you drink a gallon of fluid, your body says, oh, I only absorb at a certain rate, about a half a cup for 30 minutes. And so anything else is just going to flood into those cells and make those cells bloat. So that's the downside of drinking a lot of fluid like, you know, that contest did over a short period of time. Okay, how about questions? Did you get your blanks filled in there? Okay. What I've left for you is a set of practice problems worked out on page 38. All answers are on there for you. And what I'd like to do is just give you a few moments to try practice problems 1 through 3 on page 39. Okay, and if you want to work with somebody, feel free. I'm just going to let you fill in those answers for 1 through 3. Okay, let's hit practice problem 1. Looking at the cell and its solution, we notice that the cell is 1.4% and the solution is 2.5%. That first question says, where's your higher concentration of solutes? Yeah, outside the cell and that surrounding solution. Good. So can you predict which way water will move?
Out.
Out of the cell or in the cell?
Out.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so this is tricky because it's kind of backwards, right?
You said it always moves to the higher.
The higher, yeah. So we're going to go to the highest number, and 2.5 is higher, so water's going to go to the 2.5% solute concentration, so out. Yeah. Do you know why it's moving out?
Water follows salt.
Water follows salt, yeah. So if you move the water out, will your cell bloat or shrivel?
Shrivel.
Good. Okay, and the solution, is it more or less concentrated than your cell?
More concentrated.
More concentrated. So water is moving to that higher concentration simply to do what?
Reach
equilibrium. Yeah, try to reach the same concentration. And as it stands now, 2.5% is what to the cell?
Hyper.
Yeah, it's hypertonic. Okay, let's try the second one there. This time you've got a 0% solute concentration. That means there's no solutes in that solution. Our cell is 1.3%. The higher concentration of solutes is where?
Inside
the cell. Good. Where does water move?
Inside the cell.
Comes into the cell, right. Do you know why?
Higher concentration, water follows salt, all those are good. Okay. So if water comes in, will this cell bloat or shrivel?
Bloat.
It bloats, good. Okay. So how about that solution? Is it more concentrated or less concentrated?
Less.
Less. And let's name it hyper, hypo, or iso?
Hypo.
Okay, so it's going to make that cell bloat. All right, so how'd you do with problem number two? What's that?
I did okay. You said two.
Practice problem two. You do okay with that one? Okay.
Better than one.
I'm glad we did these because I hate for you to get on the test and then have them backwards, you know.
Yeah.
Let's do number three. Oh, let's see, higher concentration of solutes. Inside the cell, good. Where does water move?
Into the cell,
that's right. And if water moves into the cell, it's going to make that cell bloat, yeah. All right, what is more concentrated, your solution or your cell?
Cell.
So the solution is technically less concentrated than your cell. And if it's less concentrated, what word goes with that?
Hypo.
Hypo, yeah. You just got them backwards, don't you?
Yeah.
I guess that's better than having them completely confused because all you got to do is reverse it in your brain. Do y'all want to try one more?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me let you work on practice problem number four. Click. That's good. Okay, so for number four, the higher concentration of solutes is in your cell. Where does water move?
Inside
the cell, right? Because water goes to the higher number. So yeah, 3% is definitely higher than zero. And since water comes in, what happens to your cell?
It bloats.
It bloats. Good. Okay. So let's compare. The solution is more or less concentrated than your cell.
Less
concentrated, right. So 0% is certainly less than 3%. And what type of solution is this?
Hypo.
Good. So it's less concentrated. It is hypotonic. Feeling a little better about this? Okay. If you need a little more practice just to make sure you feel really good, 5, 6, 7 have answers at the bottom of the page. I'm glad we did those to clear up anything before the test on Wednesday. Anything I can help clarify on that stuff before we move along? Sure.
So a lot of times, you know, you may see a question that may have sugar. You have the solution is sugar.
Yeah, you're exactly right, because it could be sugar, it could be something we don't necessarily normally talk about, but yeah, whatever the higher concentration is, you're good rule. That's good. All right, last page of content here is 41. So we have one more type of passive transport before we wrap up that topic. And facilitated diffusion is our third and final type of passive transport. All types of passive transport require no ATP or energy. And we're still moving solutes or solution solvents, rather, along some kind of gradient. So the issue here with facilitated diffusion is that we have larger items that need to be moved. And since large items can rip holes in our plasma membrane, we now employ a protein channel which can accommodate bigger stuff. So, you know, things like polysaccharides that are rather large, we'll use a type of facilitated diffusion. And the catch is, instead of letting them wiggle their way through the phospholipid bilayer, we're going to force them to travel through this larger channel, in other words, to keep that membrane intact. So on your worksheet there, it says, how does diffusion differ from facilitated diffusion? Well, particles are bigger that travel via facilitated diffusion, so bigger particles. And what must we use to help out those bigger particles?
Integral proteins.
Integral proteins, right. So a type of integral protein known as a protein channel must be used.
Can it also be used to transport polarized substances?
Could be. Yeah, it could be for polarized stuff, yeah. Like water, because that's going to be a polarized molecule going through a pore. Exactly. One issue is you're dealing with larger particles. Okay, one issue is larger particles. And the second issue is we have to use a protein channel, which is an integral protein, because we're dealing with those larger particles. So larger particles and an integral protein called a protein channel. So the catch is with diffusion and facilitated diffusion, we're moving from high solute concentration to low solute concentration. But when we start talking about active transport and solute pumping, we're actually going against the concentration gradient. So this whole issue of achieving equilibrium is just thrown out the window when we talk about active transport. So let's head down about halfway of your page and talk about solute pumping. That is an active method for moving solutes from one point to another. And the catch here is that we're looking at moving items against their concentration gradient. So solute pumping is something we use quite frequently when we discuss things like maintaining resting potential for muscles and nerves. And one solute pump you're going to hear a lot about is called a sodium potassium pump. Okay? And so in this pump, what we're going to be doing is moving these solutes against their concentration gradient. So if you're moving against the gradient, are you going from high to low concentration or from low to high concentration?
Low to high.
Yeah, low to high. So if you're moving from low to high concentration, are you ever going to reach equilibrium?
No.
You're going against it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the catch here, is that with solute pumping, we're not moving along the concentration gradient. We're in fact moving against the gradient. Anytime you go against the flow, you're going to have to use ATP, that's an energy molecule, that helps you pump this protein and get those items moved against the concentration gradient. So down here in red, that little P represents our phosphate group from our ATP molecule. That's what we're going to use to help move us from low to high concentration. Okay, so let's just kind of summarize here. Passive transport. Are you moving high to low or low to high? High to low. Good. Oh, let's see. Okay. What is another difference between passive and active transport?
No
ATP for passive. How about for active?
ATP
is required, yeah.
And a concentration gradient, which is passive.
Yes, good.
Equilibrium,
that's another one.
Okay, so passive is high to low concentration. We're going to use no energy to move those molecules along a gradient. And the goal is equilibrium when we're talking about passive transport. With active transport, we're moving against the flow. So, you know, to say that there's no concentration gradient is actually not entirely correct because we are moving from low to high concentration. But anytime you go against the flow of things, you're going to have to use ATP energy to do that movement. So we're never going to reach equilibrium if we're moving against the flow and putting all of our solutes on one side of the membrane and not on the other side. So we won't reach equilibrium here. When our muscles are at rest and we're not moving, we actually use active transport. Yeah.
What is the third thing you
do? Here.
Yeah.
No concentration. We're not really going with the flow, we're going against it. So the concentration gradient is not helping us with this active transport. They are both passive, so you could list that entire thing out for those two. Because the only differences between them are the size of the particle being moved,
mm-hmm.
and the size now invokes us to use a protein channel.
Mm-hmm. Which makes the only difference.
That's about it. Yeah.
Other than that, they both move from high to low concentration area. They
mm-hmm.
both don't hit ATP.
That's right. There's a concentration gradient that allows movement along or with the flow. If the question had said, how is diffusion different from solute pumping, there's your answer. You know, you've got two total different things, yeah.
Okay. I think I group solute pumping in with facilitated diffusion.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, and it's the second category. Just checking to see if anybody still needs the board. I'm going to pull the screen back down. Okay, so to summarize, active transport is a type of movement against the flow, and solute pumping is what we're looking at here. You'll notice that this is a protein pump, not a channel, and the way we make that pump open is to pay it off with an ATP molecule. You can see it right down here in red. So in this case of solute pumping, we're actually going against the flow, not going from high to low, but we're going from low concentration to high concentration. And that's why we have to pump these items, is because we're going against the flow. So when we get into muscle function and nerve impulse transmission, I'll reintroduce this solute pump. It's called the sodium-potassium pump. And it's going to play a major role in helping our cells restore a resting state. So certainly an important one for us later on. Let's see, and our last types of membrane transport are also active. They're near the bottom of your page. They are called endocytosis and exocytosis. So endo and exo, those two prefixes are great clues. What does endo tell us we're doing?
Going inside.
Going inside, right. So endocytosis comes in two forms, phagocytosis and pinocytosis. Some textbooks define these as cell eating, which is phago, and cell drinking, which is pino. But we know that it's more of taking in big particles for phagocytosis and taking in smaller particles for pinocytosis. I guess you could say that's cell eating and cell drinking if you're taking in big stuff versus smaller items. A lot of times we use phagocytosis to eat enemies. You know, if you can't get rid of your enemy, just eat your enemy. And so that's how we get rid of foreign cells like bacteria and viruses in our bodies. So this looks like a ghost eating an egg, but it is endocytosis. And eventually that cell will overtake that particle and pull it in. But the catch is, we don't actually break the cell membrane. We use the cell membrane to create a little vesicle around the foreign material, and then we bring it into the cell just like this. It's just a little vesicle that we pull in. So this is a safe way to incorporate big stuff, because if you were to let these particles rip through your plasma membrane, what might happen to your cell? Could kill it, right? You could rip up that cell membrane, you could kill that cell. So I think of this as bulk transport, because we're taking lots of items, we put them in a vesicle, and then we move that vesicle around inside your cell. And that's what we've got here. So like I mentioned, bacteria may be taken in this way. Your cell just creates like a little hug around the bacteria. It pops them into a little circle. That circle is called a vesicle. And if you want to, you can destroy the bacteria and then go, and you just spit them out the other side. And so what you've got here is endocytosis moving the bacteria in. You beat them up and kill them, and then you essentially move them out by exocytosis. And what you move out is destroyed. So, you know, mission accomplished, right? This is a really cool picture. These look like long sausages, don't they? Okay, and in fact, they are anthrax, which is a really dangerous bacterium that's being eaten by a white blood cell. And I thought it was really cool, because this white blood cell is like, I'm going to eat it. I'm going to do whatever I can. I'm going to push it in. And look how it elongated that white blood cell there. So, great case of endocytosis. Another look at endocytosis here, basically the cell just gives a hug to the particles or solutes, pulls them in, there's the vesicle, and we can do whatever we want to now that the vesicle's inside the cell. So this is exocytosis. What are we doing to the vesicle this time? Exporting it out, right. So of course, keep those prefixes in mind. Endo is moving in particles, and exo is moving them out. So I think of this as bulk movement. It's easier to move large numbers of particles this way than relying on other methods. So it's kind of like tractor trailer truck bulk membrane transport. So this is massive movement of items. Okay, so that does it. That takes you down to the bottom of page 41. What can I clarify for you on this stuff?
You mean all of it, or just what we just did?
What we've just covered, anything I can help with? Diffusion, osmosis, active transport, anything there?
So I have it on there.
Okay. Why don't we do a break? And then when you come back, if you have questions, we can hit them, and we'll do just a little bit of histology when you come back from break. Let's, sure. Okay. I'd like to do just a little histology with you so we stay on track with our time, and then we'll stop about 9:30 and then do a review for our upcoming test. Page 43 starts histology. I know you guys have been looking at this in lab. We're going to look at more or less the same thing here in lecture, but the good news is this. You don't have to identify tissue pictures on the lecture test. You know, we talk about structure and function. We overlap what you all do in lab. So there's not an added issue of, oh gosh, I have to retest on these pictures again come lecture. Just overall, we've got four major tissue types: epithelial, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. And today I thought I'd just take you through a quick tour of the epithelial tissues. Y'all have it in lab test today. Okay. So I thought I'd at least get you this far through a little bit of what you're having for lab. For epithelial tissues, since they cover and line body surfaces, they are all going to have a free surface known as the apical surface and a deeper tissue called a basement membrane. So that's the attachment point to a deeper tissue. So when you look at all the tissue types and you lay one of those epithelials in front of you, you should be able to find a free apical surface where there is no attachment point.
And where we look for an abasement membrane is where we see the tissue type transition or change shape to something different. So I'm going to try my best to point these out on every picture that we look at. All right, so our first candidate here is this one. The general category is epithelial tissue. Do you recognize the specific type?
Stratified squamous.
Stratified squamous, good. Again, here's your free surface, not attached or anchored to anything. And this basement membrane here is right at the bottom where we see a transition to a different cell shape. How did you know it was stratified? Good. Many different layers, right? And where did you look for the squamous cells?
The apical surface.
Good. Look at that apical surface. And those cells up there appear somewhat flattened. These cells down there, the basement membrane, are your baby cells. They just went through mitosis, and they're not going to have the truest cell shape. So, yeah, look toward that top free surface for the truest cell shape. Let me caution you, they will flip the pictures upside down on test time. So don't get into the habit of saying, what's at top is apical, that must be my epithelial tissue. They'll sometimes rotate those things on the slides or on the pictures, so the apical surface may in fact be at the bottom. This is another epithelial tissue, another stratified squamous. In fact, the basement membrane is way down here. What you see at the top is lots of dead skin cells packed together tightly. This is an avascular tissue, meaning what?
No
blood vessels. Yeah, so the only blood getting here is simply by diffusion. And so how does diffusion work? From what to what concentration?
High to low.
High to low. So high down here where the blood vessels are, and low up there near the top, near that apical surface. And unfortunately, some of those topmost cells don't get nutrition and they die and are sloughed off. So this, in reality, is about the thickness of a piece of paper towel. You know, to us, this looks like an incredibly thick layer of tissue, but in reality, there's probably about 50 or so layers of cells here and about paper towel thickness. You know, epithelial tissues do have innervations. The nerve supply begins down in the deeper tissue layers and works their way up toward that apical surface. And they're constantly being replaced if we damage those nerve endings. So we do have sensations in our skin and our other epithelial tissues. We just do not have a direct blood supply to those tissues. So you guys are probably familiar with this from lab. The naming scheme is this. We have the number of layers that gives us part of the specific name, and then we have a specific cell shape that gives us the second half of that name. So when we're counting numbers of layers, and we say that there is a single layer, we call it a simple tissue. So let's look back at one of these previous pictures. What am I looking for to say there's a single layer? Where am I looking? Good, and I look between that surface and
basement membrane.
And so if it looks to me like there's a single layer, yeah, simple is the right name. But if it looks like two or more layers, as is the case here, what should you call it?
Stratified.
Good. So tell me about the cell shapes. If you have a squamous cell,
it's flat.
Good. I did want to mention, in case you can't see the cell shape, look for the nucleus shape. A lot of those squamous cells have a nucleus that looks like it's been squashed flat as well. So if you look toward the apical surface, you may see these nuclei that look like footballs or eggs laying on their sides. How about cuboidal cells? What's their shape?
Cube
or square. Good. How about their nucleus shape?
Round.
Good. And the last one, you can call it columnar or columnar, whichever you do. It is a brick-shaped cell, column-shaped cell. How about the nucleus in one of these?
Oval
or oval, good. So sometimes when they dye these tissues, the nucleus shows up, the cell shape does not. But yeah, use those cell shapes and their nuclei both to help you determine what you've got. Now, when you've got a multi-layered cell, the oldest cells are placed where? At the apical surface, good. So that's where your truest cell shape comes from. So we shouldn't name this one stratified cuboidal or columnar because that would be false since these cells down here at the basement membrane haven't matured into their truest cell shape yet. Instead, we should name this one stratified squamous because we're looking at those flattened cells up there near the top surface. So I should also tell you that stratified cuboidal and stratified columnar are rare. We don't cover those in class, nor do we cover them in lab. So when you're looking at a cell's tissue slide, you're going to say, yeah, it's probably not one of those since those are rare tissue types. Okay, so when we're talking about tissue names, epithelial tissue is the general category. Simple squamous, stratified columnar are the specific names. So I know you guys have been in the routine of practicing that for your lab test coming up. Just a short detour down there near the bottom of your page. A lot of our epithelial tissues have these things called cell junctions that help the cells stick together or communicate with one another. So the first one down there is called a tight junction. And like the name implies, it holds the cells sitting next to one another together tightly. So I think of it like a spot weld. You know, it literally welds one cell to the neighboring cell. And the tight junction is so tight, it prevents water from passing between those neighboring cells. So do you see any advantage of having tight junctions? What if you get into a pool or a bathtub or the salty ocean? Yeah, water can't penetrate the skin, right? So not only can it not get in, it can't get out. So this is a way to prevent water from moving through our skin to deeper layers or in the opposite direction from evaporating and leaving through your skin. So yeah, that's a great benefit to keeping us hydrated. Let's see, gap junctions are protein channels that allow for a complete open passageway between neighboring cells. The benefit of this is we let solutes and ions flow directly between neighboring cells. Have you ever stayed in a hotel room that has the creepy door to the neighbor's room? Yeah, and maybe you're not traveling with anybody you know, but you hear noise over there. And if you're like me, the first thing you do is you go and check and make sure that door's locked. Because you don't want a surprise at 3 a.m. with somebody popping through that scary little doorway, right? That's a gap junction. So if there was no gap junction to that neighboring room and you wanted to talk to who was next door, you'd have to leave your room, go knock on their door, and then come back into your room. That's a lot of trouble. So like gap junctions, it's an easy passageway between cells. You don't have to mess with all the mechanics of the cell membrane this way. The last type of cell junction is this one called a desmosome. Do you know what the prefix desmo tells us? Desmo means band, okay? And some means body. You ever do a three-legged race? Okay, not fun, right? Okay, so if they fall, you fall. If they run, you run. You do what they do, right? They do what you do. That's what desmosomes do. They link cells together by banding them together. And I always think about my elbow when I think about desmosomes. You know, if you bend your elbow, all that skin has to stretch over that elbow. And of course, when you flatten it out, we're good to go. But it's that stretch that we have to experience when our knees and our elbows bend. So if one cell gets pulled, guess what the neighbor does? It gets pulled too, yeah, so these are bands that literally link one cell to the next. It's supposed to prevent overstretching and tearing because it allows cells to kind of go with each other rather than just ripping and tearing apart. So when your skin is really dry and your skin peels off in layers, which of these three is going to band those cells together? Desmosomes, good. What was the clue?
Band.
Yeah. If you get into a swimming pool and you stay there for 4 hours and you don't get out, you get out and you don't weigh an ounce heavier than you did when you got in, What was keeping you from swelling?
Tight junctions.
Tight junctions, exactly. Good. All right, so that should wrap up page 43. How about questions there? Okay, let's try page 44. We're just going to do a rundown of those tissues. So simple squamous has how many cell layers?
One.
Just one. Good. So this is an odd one to look at because our most common example is lung tissue. And it's kind of wacky because, you know, you're looking for an apical surface and a basement membrane, and it's not really set up the way you would expect to see it. This is a low magnification sample of lung tissue. What you're seeing are alveolar air sacs. And then you've got these big things, which are either blood vessels or bronchial tubes passing through the lungs. So at low magnification, this looks to me like soapy bubbles. You know, you're washing dishes, you got soapy bubbles. They are, in fact, as thin as a soap bubble. You know, that's the reality with simple squamous epithelial tissue. When you zoom in on this, you know, you're not looking for perfection here. You're looking for what looks to be more or less a single layer of cells. So that's what we've got here, is we've got more or less a single layer, and they're arranged in this picture like little air sacs. There's some great ones up here toward the top. So I'm getting the sense that I have a single layer. The nucleus looks fairly flattened. And how did you confirm that this was epithelial to begin with?
Apical
surface and basement membrane. So definitely you can see the free edge here. There's nothing else attached to it. Basement membrane's a little harder to discern in this picture, but I think you can say without a doubt that this is an epithelial tissue because of that free surface. Another one here, you know, we're not looking, like I said, for perfection. We're getting an average of about a cell or so per alveolar air sac here. So this is the classic example that we use in both lecture and lab for simple squamous epithelial tissue. Now, in addition to alveolar lung air sacs, where else can we find simple squamous?
Kidney
glomeruli, which are capillaries. Capillaries elsewhere are lined with this. Blood vessels are lined with it. Okay. Can you tell me two functions for this one?
Filtration
and diffusion. So we know about diffusion, all that high to low movement. Filtration is what happens when we push fluids out due to high pressure, something we'll actually talk about more in Bio 211. I just want to caution you, if you have been searching the internet for this stuff, a lot of oddball pictures will pop up. This is simple squamous, but it's not a side view, not a cross section. This is a top-down view. So, you know, if you have been searching the internet, just beware of what you look at. Okay, so this next picture is a stratified squamous epithelial tissue. Just to start off with, how can you confirm it is epithelial tissue? Good. Okay, there's your free surface. There's your basement membrane. Good. And you're estimating there's two or more layers, right? Okay. So, in fact, where are your oldest cells?
At the top.
At the top, good. And what shape do they take on?
Flat.
Flat, right. If you looked instead toward the basement membrane, you might be fooled into thinking that these are what? Cuboidal or columnar, yeah. So, yeah, that's why we say, hey, look toward the apical surface. That's going to give you the truest cell shape. Basement membrane has got the newest cells. So where do you find stratified squamous? Epidermis. Good. Lining of
mouth.
Esophagus. Vagina. Good. So what comes in must go out, right? Okay, so you're right. These areas up here, like mouth and esophagus, and on a female, vagina, and everybody, anal canal. There's a lot of friction there, so we need the multi-layers of stratified squamous to handle that abrasion. Now, some of these tissues happen to be keratinized, and some happen to be non-keratinized. So let's establish what is keratin. Waterproofing. Good. It is a waterproofing protein. It is meant to keep you dry. So where do you have that specifically?
Your epidermis.
Yeah, epidermis of your skin. The inside of your mouth feels slick and slimy compared to your skin. So the inside of your mouth, the esophagus, vagina, anal canal are non-keratinized. Meaning what? Yeah, no waterproofing there. So we're not going to ask you the difference on a picture in lab, but I thought it'd be cool to see that there is no keratin on this particular stratified squamous, and there is keratin that makes a waterproofing protein on this particular picture. So, yeah, it's just one thing that we see differentiating certain types of stratified squamous. On this picture, I did want to mention that all of this is stratified squamous. Down here is your basement membrane, and I want you to notice how it's groovy. And it sticks together with your underlying tissue layers because of that grooviness. Some people describe it as an egg crate appearance, and it's good for us that there is this grooviness. What if there was a flat, straight transition between epidermis and underlying connective tissues? You might not be able to stretch, and what happens if you rub those layers? Stretch apart, yeah. So if they're locked instead, when you're rubbing those layers past one another, they're grooved together and less likely to friction apart. So when you do get a water blister on your foot from a brand new shoe, you've actually gotten fluid trapped between those layers where they've been rubbing past each other. So, you know, that's not a very comfortable experience. Okay. Let's see, we've got simple cuboidal. How many layers here?
Mm-hmm.
Just one. And the predominant cell shape?
Cubed
or squared. Good. All right, where is the apical surface in this picture? At the bottom, yeah. So, yeah, like I said, don't let them fool you on the lab test. Those pictures or slides may be upside down. And this is your apical surface. And right along here is your basement membrane where we connect to something else. Nice round cube-shaped cells, and then what kinds of cell structures are these? Cilia. Yeah, so some of these, in fact, may be ciliated. All right, so what is this?
Simple
cuboidal, good. General category? Epithelial, good. Can you tell me two locations for it? Yeah, this is kidney tubules, in fact. You're looking down on what looks like little tubes or drinking straws, and the apical surface is the white space in here, and the basement membrane is around the backside. So, yeah, this is great kidney tubules, and you're right, ovary surface is another place where we have this stuff. Good. How about two functions for this? Good. Secretion and absorption. Why do you think a simple tissue is better than a stratified tissue for that job? Not keratinized. Only one layer, right? You don't have to work against multiple layers to get items secreted out of the tissue or into the bloodstream. Okay. We know that glands are also made up of simple cuboidal. Sweat glands, oil glands have this type of tissue lining their ducts or passageways. So you can see a little bit of it in this picture here. And a little more of it here. You can see some of those passageways lined with simple cuboidal. Looks like our next one is simple columnar or columnar. Again, how many cell layers?
One.
Good. And predominant cell shape?
Column.
Good. Can you spot the apical surface here?
Yeah.
Yeah, round. So you've got the apical surface here, and inside you've got the basement membrane. And embedded within these cells, you also have specialized cells known as?
Goblet cells.
Good. What do they make and release? Mucus. Good. Can you give me two locations for this one? Good. Lining of the digestive tract like stomach and intestines. Gallbladder is another great place for this. So a lot of these pictures have the same general setup. This one just happens to be ciliated, and you're looking for about one layer of cells between the apical surface and that basement membrane. Okay, do you spot any goblet cells here?
Yes.
How about right there? Do you see some others? Maybe down here? Okay, so is this one stratified or simple?
Simple.
Good. How do you know it's not stratified?
No.
One layer. Yes, so here's your basement, okay, and up here is your apical surface. This happens to be something else, like a connective tissue, and down here is another layer of simple tissue. All right, how about this one? What specific type?
Simple columnar.
Simple columnar, good. Good. Epithelial. So, a couple of pretty goblet cells embedded in this dark picture. And even more goblet cells here. What do they make?
Mucus.
Mucus, good. Okay. So, this is the lining of our small intestine. It has these finger-like extensions called villi, and they're just an awesome example because you've got all these simple columnar cells lining these villi up and down these hills here. Okay, this one's an oddball. This one is pseudostratified columnar, and the pseudo prefix tells us what?
False.
So it looks like it's falsely stratified. In fact, it's actually a simple tissue. So you say, well, why did they just call it simple? Well, I guess not to confuse us with the previous picture that we saw. So let's take a look at this one. In fact, every cell in pseudostratified columnar is touching the basement membrane. I know it doesn't look like it from this picture, but every one of these jumbled cells really makes contact down here with this basement. I believe every picture we show in lecture and lab is ciliated. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there you go. You've got that nice field of cilia at the top of that tissue. So do you find the cilia at the basement membrane or the apical surface?
Apical surface.
Apical surface, good. So how do you know this is a columnar tissue? Good, oblong shaped nucleus, right? And the cells look more or less elongated. So the weirdness is they in fact do touch that basement membrane. So don't convince yourself you see layers here. There are not true layers in this tissue. They're falsely layered, even though it looks like you've got a couple of layers sitting there. So when they make these tissue cuts, they use a teeny tiny knife called a microtome, and they can't get it thin enough to make it look like it's truly, you know, the right type of tissue. So that's why we end up having these strange looking slices like you see here. Okay. Where do you find this one?
Nasal cavity and trachea.
Good. Lining of the nasal cavity, trachea.
Bronchi.
Is male urethra in your...
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure you had that one too.
It's the portions of the lower.
Okay, that's good. How about functions for this one?
For protection and propel mucus.
Good. Definitely propelling mucus up here in the respiratory, right? And that's a good thing to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't noticed the trend here, notice that simple columnar is often found in your digestive tract, gallbladder, intestine, stomach, and notice that pseudostratified is often found in your nasal cavity, your respiratory tract. So there's some generalizations you can make here to help you keep it straight. So transitional is our last epithelial tissue, and it's transitional because it changes shape. And it's an odd one again because it looks stratified, and it really is stratified, but notice the orientation of the cells. These cells don't necessarily look squamous at the apical surface, do they? Okay, so up here is our apical surface, all along here, and notice the cell shape. What do they actually look like? Kind of cuboidal, maybe columnar, okay? And so that's your first clue that says, I am not stratified squamous. Look at the cell shape at the apical surface. The second thing to notice is all of these cells look like they're pointing where? Yeah, toward the basement membrane, right? They're tear-shaped or column-shaped, and they're all pointing toward that basement membrane, which in this picture sits right around there.
So when you stretch this tissue, they can spread out. And then, of course, when you relax it, they can go back to their original shape. Which system has a lot of transitional tissue? Yeah, ureters, bladder, urethra, yeah. So what are these organs doing a lot of?
Stretching,
good, and distending. So they're holding urine, they're going to have to stretch in order to accommodate that urine. All right, so how about this one? Stratified squamous or transitional?
Transitional.
It's transitional. How do you know? It doesn't look squamous. Yeah, these are actually round nuclei here at the apical surface, and these actually look columnar, pointing toward your basement membrane. Yeah. So just for comparison's sake, there you go. Flattened cells in squamous and teardrop-shaped cells in transitional. All right, so that kind of does our quick tour of epithelial tissues. We can keep going. I can do a review of tissues with you for your lab test, or we can just cut it off and then open the floor for your test in here on Wednesday.
Test here on Wednesday.
Test here on Wednesday. Okay. So let me know, what's your first question for Wednesday? Anything from homeostasis?
Not the chemistry thing. We just need to know the four elements on that chart.
I'd know all of them, like what they do, like iodine or calcium, for instance.
So you know all of them.
I know all of them, yeah. And we'll hit on them throughout this course and the next.
Okay.
Well, y'all get a chance to sign in on the attendance roster. Okay. Something about covalent bonding and how to write it shorthand?
Yeah.
Okay. So in this picture here, we've got carbon and four hydrogens. What type of bond holds all of them together?
Single.
Good. So when I write this and I put my carbon and my hydrogen there, where should I put the subscript of four?
By the H.
Yeah, by the hydrogen. Would putting it in front have been the right way to go?
No, I mean I have four carbons
as well. Yeah, so I don't want to tell the wrong story there. So yeah, don't put the four in the front. Okay. Do I need a one here?
No.
It's understood. Good. Okay. How about all these oxygens? What types of bond holds them together?
Double bond.
So there's two pairs of electrons being shared by each oxygen in that relationship. And if I want to write this shorthand, I want to tell somebody that I have how many oxygens? Have three. So should I put a three in front or three as a subscript?
Three as a subscript.
Good. What does that tell somebody?
That is bonded.
That is bonded, right. This tells somebody?
Three separate oxygens.
Yeah, three separate oxygens. So one here and another one, yeah, so we're not going to use 3O. Okay, the last one has nitrogen triple bonded to nitrogen. What does a triple bond indicate?
Sharing six electrons,
good. Three pairs or six electrons. And then again, if we want to write this shorthand, how do we do it?
N2.
N2, good. So what does the 2 as a subscript indicate?
They're
bonded, they're sharing electrons, they're paired up. So I noticed in an old test that this happens to be a commonly missed set of questions. So if it asks you to write shorthand, you know, yeah, it's bonded, but that's all you need to know. You don't necessarily need to know what type of bond is there, just the simple fact that they're bonded together.
Okay.
Good? Okay. Any other questions on this?
So, you know how, like, on the test, you have, like, you show the orbital, and then they have four molecules. It's still a double bond, right? It's just four.
Like with this one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you've got four electrons lined up there, it's still a double bond.
Okay.
Yeah. Or if you had six lined up there, it's a triple.
Triple bond.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to see that?
No, I'm looking at one of the things.
Okay.
I was trying to explain it without having an electron.
Good, okay.
You would have, like, you would have three atoms together, and in the middle they'll have a different bond, and then the outside they'll have a different bond. You would ask which specific bond you would be talking about.
Yeah, I'm going to give you two different kinds of bonds and then let you guys guess. I'd be very specific. I might draw an arrow to it,
right,
or I might say the carbon and the oxygen, what's
right
there. Yeah. How about more chemistry, since we're on that topic? That's right. Yeah. The overwhelming majority of systems operate with negative. Yeah. Anything on organelles? Okay, so we're looking at acids and bases.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the way it gives off the hydrogen and the hydroxyl.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's review the pH scale. The pH scale is based on hydrogen concentration in a solution. And that just happens to be the way that we use the one set up. As you approach zero on the pH scale, you're looking at a chemical that releases a lot of hydrogens. That would be a strong acid. And some examples of that would be things like H2SO4. Keep in mind that we're going to use a general rule of thumb that H in the beginning is an indicator of an acid. Other acids could be things like HCl. In our bodies, that's hydrochloric acid. So as you get closer to zero, though, we're looking at a neutral substance, not to be confused with the acids. It does have hydrogens in the front, but water is neutral because it releases equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls. In fact, if you're looking at acids close to 7, say around 5 or 6, they don't release nearly as many hydrogens as a pH of 0. So your extreme ends are going to release more of the hydrogens versus hydroxyls at the other end. So as we head up here toward 14, these bases release more hydroxyls than they do hydrogens. So things like NaOH, you know, KOH, these kinds of bases have that OH ending. As you get closer to 14, you're looking at a very strong base. As you go toward 7, you're looking at a very weak base. The catch is we're working on a continuum here. You know, acids do release a little bit of hydroxides, but in reality, the bases release more than an acid in terms of hydroxides and vice versa. Okay, so if you had to select a number for a strong acid, what would you pick?
0, 1, 2,
somewhere in that neighborhood.
Would 0 be more acidic than 1?
0 is more acidic than 1, exactly.
So that is a number, that is a...
Oddly enough, it is an option, yeah.
Option.
normally, if I have 0 or something, I'm going to be right, but yeah, it's an option.
Okay.
And,
do like
10
times,
or
100?
10 times, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's compare. Let's compare pH of 8 to 10. Mm-hmm. 100 times, good. Let me just caution you that on the test, you're going to have options like 20. Don't get into that trap, right? So it's either 10 to the power of 2 or multiply it out, and it's 100, okay? So is 8 100 times more basic, or is 10 100 times more basic?
10
is 100 times more basic, yeah. Which one of these releases 100 times more hydroxides?
10,
good. Which one of these is actually 100 times more acidic?
Eight,
yeah, and it also releases 100 times more
hydrogens,
yeah. So you want to be comfortable flip-flopping between those two numbers.
Are we going to have to know that acids in nature enzymes?
I would know that acids and heat in nature enzymes, yeah. That's a good thing to know. Do you have anything else I can review for you today?
Ask which one of those are base or acid or something like that you might ask us to.
Yeah, I'm going to say, I've got this, what
yes.
is it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how to spot it?
The H, the OH is the base.
That's
the
other.
The hydrogen. The H is the acid.
That's right, good. Saturated means. No, don't worry about the examples. I may show you some and then say pick the saturated fat or the unsaturated or polyunsaturated. Sure. Okay, next question is chronic heart failure as a positive feedback mechanism. Okay, so first of all, what is positive feedback going to do to the stimulus?
Enhance
it, right. So when people have chronic heart failure, their hearts get big and flabby and they're becoming less effective as a pump. In order to maintain blood pressure, what happens is the heart is going to have to pump even harder, which makes it bigger and even flabbier as a pump. In order to maintain blood pressure, the heart has to work even harder, so it gets bigger and flabbier as a pump. So you can see that the flabbiness and the loss of muscle tone in the heart muscle tissue is going to encourage a higher pressure. And if the vessels are constricted due to heart, you know, problems or vascular disease, then the heart continues to become larger and more flabby as a pump. So it just continues making the heart bigger and flabbier. Okay.
Until
what?
Until
a person dies or has a heart transplant. Yeah. Yep. So there's no good outcome for that one. Yep. I know, it should be negative, shouldn't it, for the sadness that it has. Yep. I don't know if you've noticed or been watching the egg yolks, but I think you can see a big difference now.
Notice that one's on hypotonic fluid. See how swollen it is?
Mm-hmm.
And this bright yellow one is in hypertonic fluid. So pretty cool. You can start to see a difference here. Only 2 hours after I set them up. All right, what's your next question? Sure, transcription, translation. So this is how it's going to look on the test. It's actually one you have to write out an answer. It's going to be a two-part question asking you to transcribe the strand of DNA first and then turn around and translate it. You guys don't have to memorize that codon chart. It's going to be provided for you on the test paper. So the first thing you'll want to do is make sure you rewrite the T's here that you normally would do into U's. Okay. So as we start transcribing, A,
U,
G,
good,
G,
C,
C,
G,
U,
A,
U,
A,
and A. Okay. So if you've got that far, you've at least got the transcription portion done correctly, I would encourage you to go ahead and divide this into codons, which are groups of threes. And what you actually made here is called messenger RNA, or mRNA. mRNA carries the code, and then tRNA has to come in and act as the translator. So we're going to play the role of tRNA. I believe in your course pack we can flip back and take a look at that codon chart. All right, and that's in the bottom of page 30. So how about the codon that we have for A and B? What amino acid did that code you on?
Start.
Yes.
Start.
You're right, start, and technically it's methionine, you're right. Okay, and you can write either one for the test, okay? How about GGC? How does that code?
Glycine.
Glycine, good. Okay, and CUA?
Leucine.
Leucine, yeah. And how about the last one? UAA?
Stop.
Good. And as promised, I will build in a start and a stop codon for you guys so you know you've done the translation process properly.
After we translate, would you ask
the first time? I probably won't. Yeah, I'll just ask you to do these two steps and then that's it. Any questions on transcription translation? Got just a few minutes left. Do you have any last questions for Wednesday? I wish we're going to do connective tissues afterwards. Yeah. Is it time? Yeah, about an hour and 15. About 9:15, we'll start back with connective tissues.